We work hard to stay current with pop culture here at our church. And for you movie buffs out there, the next Marvel movie to be released will be Black Widow, starring Scarlett Johansson, on November 6, 2020. For those of you unfamiliar with superheroes and comic books and all things nerd, the Black Widow character is a Russian super spy, martial artist, and sniper named Natalia Romanova, or Natasha Romanoff, depending on what alias she's using at the time. Her backstory has changed over the years, but the original account has her being orphaned during the Battle of Stalingrad in World War II. She was trained, aka brainwashed, by the KGB in the dark arts of espionage, seduction, and assassination. Eventually, she broke loose and defected to the United States, where she now works tirelessly to make up for all the wrong she had done in her past. And that's all well and good. We love a good redemption story. But did you know that in the annals of Russian history during the World War II era, there was a real-life Black Widow? She wasn't a super spy, necessarily, but she was combat-trained. She was deeply loyal to the motherland, and she killed a lot of Nazis. She was a literal widow, and her name was Maria Oktyabrskaya. The story of Maria Oktyabrskaya is so amazing that I didn't believe it at first. Reliable references and citations concerning Maria are few and far between in English, and I was suspicious that she may have been just a figment of Soviet-era propaganda. So I did a deep dive online, and I found some well-researched Russian sources that lend credibility to her incredible story. Maria Oktyabrskaya was born into a poor Russian serf family on the Crimean Peninsula in either 1902 or 1905, depending on the source. She was one of 10 children. After the Bolshevik Revolution, she became a committed communist and married a Soviet officer named Ilya Riednanka. They were so committed to the communist cause that they changed their surname to October in honor of the October Revolution of 1917. Maria loyally followed her husband from garrison to garrison, and she even trained with him. She acquired combat and communication skills, trained as a medic, and learned to operate a machine gun. But when the Nazis invaded Russia in 1941, Maria was evacuated deep into Russia, while Ilya was sent to the front lines. She faithfully served the motherland as a radio operator until she received word 2 years later that her husband had been killed in the Battle of Kiev. And from that point on, Maria Oktyabrskaya was a woman on fire. All Russians hated the Nazis, but Maria's loathing and fury turned her into a black widow of sorts. She committed her life not just to expelling Hitler's army from her homeland, but to killing as many Nazis on the way out as possible. She volunteered to fight on the front lines, as did many Russian women during World War II. But she was rejected at first due to her age, being in her late 30s at the time. Undeterred, she sold all her earthly possessions and raised money to build a tank. It wasn't unusual for patriotic Russians to donate military equipment during World War II. But what was unusual in Maria's case was the one condition she set for contributing the tank to the Red Army, which she laid out in a telegram to Joseph Stalin. It read, "In the battles for the motherland, my husband was killed. For his death, for the death of all Soviet people tortured by fascist barbarians, I want revenge on these fascist dogs, a cause for which I contributed all my personal savings into the state bank as a means to build a tank, 50,000 rubles. I request that the tank be named Combat Girlfriend and that I be allowed to operate it during frontline operations. I can already drive and operate a machine gun, and I have been trained as a sharpshooter. I send you my warmest greetings and wish you long, long years of life. May you strike fear into our enemies and for the eternal glory of our socialist motherland." Well, that telegram seemed to push all the right buttons for good old Uncle Joe, and he immediately enrolled Maria into the Soviet tank program. Enthusiastically, she completed her 5 months of training And in September of 1943, she was posted to the 26th Guards Tank Brigade as a driver and mechanic. Her comrades were immediately skeptical. They saw her as little more than a publicity stunt. But their cynicism turned to respect the very next month as they watched her boldly maneuver her tank through enemy lines and bury the Nazis. During the tank battle, her machine was crippled by enemy fire. But Maria was promoted to sergeant after leaping from the tank and making repairs in mid-battle. Maria continued to rampage for the next several months, leaving dozens of dead Nazi machine gunners in her wake. But then on January 17, 1944, during the Leningrad Offensive, the tracks on Maria's tank were blown off. Again, she emerged from the tank to make repairs. But this time, she was struck on the head by shrapnel and fell into a coma, which ultimately took her life 2 months later. On August 2, 1944, Maria Oktyabrskaya was posthumously awarded the title Hero of the Soviet Union, the highest Soviet honor for her courage and heroism in battle. We hear the story of Maria Oktyabrskaya, and we're not sure if we should revere her or feel sorry for her. Maria Oktyabrskaya refused to be victimized. She would not allow her status as a war widow to render her powerless. And she went out in a blaze of glory. But at the same time, she was zealously committed to a questionable cause. She was driven by hatred and consumed with rage. And in the end, it cost her everything. Maria Oktyabrskaya is a tragic hero of Russian history. And I suppose all widows can claim the mantle of tragic hero to some extent. No one asks to be a widow. The death of a spouse is always tragic. But out of such tragedy, there are always opportunities for heroes to emerge. And nowhere was this needed more than the first century church in Ephesus. As we'll see in our passage today, the young leader Timothy was faced with a crisis. An influx of desperate widows seeking food, shelter, and protection had inundated the church, and it became clear that a theoretical, idealistic, Tim practical faith just wouldn't cut it. Love would need to be concrete, useful, and hands-on in order to save them. But as is always the case, the need exceeded the available resources. So in our passage today, the Apostle Paul advised Timothy on how to manage this enormously complex problem with a remarkably simple strategy. This little leadership strategy can help us resolve any difficulty we may face today that involves people. And let's face it, our problems always involve people. So take out your Bible and turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 1 through 16. You can also pull up the passage on your smartphone or tablet. And as always, there are notes that you can use. This is the seventh installment in our original series entitled Mission Timpossible, the Timothy Dossier. You may be familiar with the dossier seen from the Mission Impossible franchise. The team leader would sift through the files of different agents available for the mission. Some dossiers he would toss aside, but a few he would choose for the operation. Well, as we've been mentioning the past couple of weeks, the team leader in the book of 1 Timothy is the Apostle Paul. The mission is to somehow keep together the dysfunctional church in the ancient town of Ephesus that's being splintered by nefarious influences. And the dossier he chooses for this impossible mission is that of a young pastor named Timothy, whom he addresses in today's passage. 1 Timothy chapter 5, starting in verse 1, Paul writes, "Do not rebuke an older man, but encourage him as you would a father, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, in all purity. Honor widows who are truly widows. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. Command these things as well, so that they may be without reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, and having a reputation for good works. She has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. But refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. For some have already strayed after Satan. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened so that it may care for those who are truly widows. Now, for the past couple of weeks, we've seen Paul's thoughts on leadership in the abstract. Paul painted a portrait of what a good Christian leader should look like. But in the passage we just read, Paul gave Timothy a good, practical, concrete example of how to lead in this particular crisis involving widows. As we've said, widowhood is a tragic part of everyday life. But in ancient times, widowhood was not just emotionally devastating, it was downright perilous. There were very few jobs back then for women. There were no female tank commanders to fall back on. The back-breaking labor of ancient times was done by men, who had significantly shorter lifespans than women. So when a woman's husband died, unless she had significant savings or help from other family members, she was in real danger of falling into total desolation. But when Christian churches started popping up across Asia Minor, suddenly there was hope. At these new religious gatherings, people promoted the life, philosophy, and mission of a man named Jesus. But he was more than a man. He lived a perfect life. He was killed by the political system of Rome, not for his own sins, but for the sins of everyone else. And he was resurrected 3 days later to prove his claims of messiahship. He was the Son of God. And he declared that all who simply trust in him will inherit eternal life, not as a wage to be earned with good works, but as a free gift to be received by faith. Jesus says in John 6:40, "For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who looks on the Son and believes in him should have eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day." But the Jesus philosophy was about more than just flying off to heaven someday. It was about living the best life right now. And the way to live your best life right now and foster the best life of those around you is through love. Jesus said in John 13:34-35, "A new command I give to you, you are to love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another." In a world with no government assistance, no welfare programs, and no one really looking out for his neighbor, suddenly these Christians were volunteering to support those who could not support themselves. Even though these needy people could offer nothing in return, and many of these Christians were needy themselves, they were still taking people in and caring for them. They were caring for widows, orphans, the elderly, and the infirm. They were collecting abandoned babies from the roadsides and raising them as their own. It was a beautiful thing. So the widows in Ephesus were flocking to the church, but there was only so much help available. And it was becoming a real crisis for Timothy. How could he distribute these limited resources fairly? Who would get excluded? But in the midst of this mess, Paul offers a simple, clear strategy that can be applied to any people problem, really. First, Paul gave a general principle, and then he showed Timothy how to apply that principle to this particular problem. And the general principle is found in verses 1 and 2. He basically told Timothy to treat everyone in the church as he would his own father, brother, mother, or sister. In other words, he was to love them as he loved his own family. This principle, of course, started with Jesus, who said in Matthew 12:49, "Here are my mother and my brother, as he gestured towards those disciples around him. And Paul expounded on this principle elsewhere. In Romans 12:10, he writes, love each other as brothers and sisters and honor others more than you do yourself. So that is the foundation for solving every people problem, whether it be at home, at work, at church, or in the community. It's love. It's truly doing what's best for other people. It's looking out for their best interests before your own. You see, love is not Tim Practical. No matter how complex the problem may be, any problem with people can be reduced to this simple axiom. The leader simply must ask himself, what is the best interest of those I am leading? For Timothy, he had to ask himself, what must I do to bring about the best outcome for these widows? And that's our main point from today's passage. The main point is, Timothy was to love them and lead them. He was to love them and lead them. In verses 3 through 16, which we're looking at today, Paul showed how to work out this love leadership principle among the older and younger women mentioned in verse 2. And in verses 17 through 25, which we'll look at next week, Paul showed how to work out this love leadership principle among the men mentioned in verse 1. But as Timothy was facing this complex crisis with the widows, he needed to ask himself a simple question as a leader. What is in the best interest of these widows who are looking to me for leadership? Leading is loving, and loving is leading. That's how God led his people through the wilderness. It says in Exodus 15:13, in your unfailing love you will lead the people you have redeemed. Maria Oktyabrskaya didn't so much love her people as she hated her enemy. But true leaders love their followers. No matter what, they look out for the best interest of those who depend on them. And sometimes what merely looks like the loving thing to do on the surface may not be what's truly best for them. Sometimes the most loving thing to do for one person may not be the most loving thing for someone else. Love is simple, but actually applying it to different people in different situations takes some wisdom. But good leaders take the simple principle of love and apply it to the complex problems they face among people. A good leader must recognize what's in the best interest for each individual that he leads, and he must be willing to work toward their best interest, no matter how difficult, misunderstood, or unpopular it may be. So let's see how Jesus' philosophy of love applied to the widows under Timothy's care. Paul divided the widows into two main categories. He separated the older widows from the younger widows. And he revealed to Timothy that how he showed love to the older widows would look much different than how he showed love to the younger widows. What was in the best interest of the older widows was much different than what was in the best interest of the younger widows. As a matter of fact, the way he showed love to the younger widows wouldn't look much like love at all on the surface. It would be difficult, but that's what leaders do. They don't just manage people. They don't try to keep everyone happy, which is impossible to do anyway. They actually love people no matter what that love may look like. And for the older widows, the loving thing to do was to continue to support them financially. He was to continue feeding them. Now, he was to encourage them to live godly lives. They were not to be lazy or self-indulgent. But if you read the passage closely, you'll see that their support was not contingent upon behavior. It was not be good or else. Love is not contingent upon behavior, mind you. Love is not based upon the goodness of the recipient. Love is not given only to those who have somehow been deemed to deserve it. You don't earn love. Love is based on grace. So even though Timothy was encouraging these widows to be godly examples, nowhere does it say he's going to kick them off the list if they don't measure up. Now, Paul did command families to take care of their own widows. They should be the first to show practical love to the widows and their families. But behavior or family situation wasn't the sole determining factors whether or not someone was unenrolled from the list of widows receiving aid from the church. If you read closely, you'll see that the main determining factor for being removed from the list was age. The younger widows should be removed from this list, and Paul gave the approximate age of 60 as the guideline. But why age? That doesn't seem like love, does it? How cruel is it to remove someone from the church's welfare rolls simply because of their age? But don't lose sight of our original principle. A loving leader does what's in the best interest of his people in the long term, even if it doesn't look like love in the short term. So why was it more loving to feed the older widows but not the younger widows? Well, Paul reasoned that the younger widows would be more likely to have the opportunity to get married again, while the older ones would have a harder time finding a husband. Now, Paul wasn't saying that marriage was the ultimate fix to all women's problems. But remember, women couldn't work back then, for the most part. Really, the only job available to them in that society was that of a wife and mom. So in essence, Paul is saying that if a woman could find a job, then by all means, work. If she could find a husband, then remarry. Look, it's not that the church didn't want to help them. But even if the church had unlimited resources, the most loving thing to do in this situation would still be to advise a woman to work to support herself, in this case, as the manager of her husband's household. This notion isn't based upon the indignation of the giver, as in, I'm working hard, so you need to work hard too. As we said, love isn't fair. But if it was at all possible, it was truly in the widow's best interest to remarry so she could work. So why? Most of us try to avoid work. Why would it be in her best interest to work? Well, the simple answer is that a life without work is miserable and destructive. Paul described this kind of self-indulgent life as a living death. Even the widows who were too old to get remarried were still advised to keep busy with good things. They should pray, serve, and show hospitality. But as soon as these widows would stop working, they'd have nothing to do but go from door to door making a nuisance of themselves. With nothing useful and honorable to occupy their time, they'd have the opportunity to gossip and start dalliances with married men, possibly. And it would destroy their lives. In a very real way, this meaningless life of self-indulgence, though it may seem great from the outside, would only lead to misery. Now, how do we know this? Because King Solomon tried it. He described this kind of living death in his book of wisdom called Ecclesiastes. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, he writes, "For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that's done under the sun. Go then, eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with a woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun, for this is your reward in life and in all your toil in which you have labored under the sun." And so Solomon was so rich, he never had to work another day in his life. So he didn't. He filled his time indulging in all sorts of trivialities. But he found that these things couldn't replace the simple joy of real work. For Solomon, the worst part about dying was not getting to work anymore. It's better to be alive and working than dead and not working. And that's why God has designed us to continue working, even in the life to come. It says in Revelation 22:3, "No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him." Then Solomon tells us why we are miserable without work. In Ecclesiastes 5:20, he says, "The laborers seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. Work keeps us from dwelling on ourselves and suffering an existential crisis. That's why people who work so hard in underprivileged countries oftentimes seem very happy. They don't have time to dwell on the futility of life. They just love their families and enjoy their lives and take pride in their work. So whether these widows realized it or not, a life of self-indulgence was not what they really wanted. By cutting them from the welfare rolls, Timothy was truly acting in their best interest. They would be so much happier and more fulfilled when they busied themselves with the honorable work of managing a household and being the woman of one man, as he calls it. Now, I'm sure this didn't go over well when Timothy made this announcement. I'm sure he wasn't the most popular guy with the younger widows after he cut them off. It seemed harsh, unfair, impractical. But a good leader truly seeks out the best interest of their followers, even if their followers don't agree, especially at first. And that's our application from this morning's passage. The application is feed people to be good, lead people to be great. We must feed people to be good people, but we must lead people to become great people. The presidency of John Adams has divided historians. Most view his presidency as somewhat of a failure, especially when it came to foreign policy and his acquiescence to the Alien and Sedition Act. You see, John Adams had never been the most popular man in the room, not even within his own Federalist Party. Adams won his first presidential election in large part because he had been the vice president, an heir apparent of the very popular George Washington. But Alexander Hamilton was the real leader of the Federalists. Hamilton enjoyed influence among the Federalists in Congress, and even Adams's own cabinet was loyal to Hamilton. So despite belonging to the same party, Hamilton worked to undermine President Adams at every opportunity. And this was most evident in Hamilton's desire for war with France. The French had been harassing American ships at sea, and American sailors were fighting back. It became known as the Quasi-War. It wasn't an official war, but it was really close. And while Adams publicly rattled the war sabers against France and built up the nation's army and navy, behind the scenes he was doing everything in his power to avoid a full-blown war. In a letter to his wife Abigail many years prior, Adams had declared, "Great is the guilt of unnecessary war." So now he had to live up to those ideals, even if it wasn't popular within his own party. American sailors were starting to find some success against the French, which only emboldened Hamilton and the war hawks in Congress. On top of that, the French had insulted an American peace delegation, bringing war cries to a fever pitch. But Adams resisted escalation. He knew the infant nation could not survive the war for which they were clamoring with the French. So to the chagrin of his own party, Adams sent another peace delegation to France. This effectively split the Federalists, ruining any chances of Adams' re-election, and it even destroyed the party. But by September of 1800, the delegation got the job done, and war was avoided. John Adams was trounced in the presidential election a few months later, only managing to come in third. But in the end, John Adams had no regret, as he wrote several years later. He wrote, "I will defend my missions to France as long as I have an eye to direct my hand or a finger to hold my pen. I desire no other inscription over my gravestone than 'Here lies John Adams, who took upon himself the responsibility of the peace with France in the year 1800. You see, good people work to give people what they want. They feed people. But great people work to give people what they need. great people work to give people what's truly in their best interest, even when those people don't know what's in their best interest. That's the difference between really leading people and simply feeding them. If you want to be liked, then just feed people. But if you want to lead, then truly love people. Real leaders actually do what's in their people's best interest, just as God does. The author of Hebrews writes in chapter 12, verse 6, "The Lord disciplines the one he loves." He goes on to say in verses 9 through 11, "We have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to them. But he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." Being a leader is not easy, but it is somewhat simple. Do what's best for your followers, even if it hurts them temporarily. Do what's best for your followers, even if it makes you unpopular. Do what's best for your followers, even if it requires an uncomfortable conversation. Do what's best for your followers, even if it isn't in your own best interest. Once you resolve in your heart that a particular decision is truly in your people's best interest, then it becomes a little easier. And it doesn't matter what the problem is or with whom. This simple axiom works in every complex, messy people problem, whether you're a CEO, a middle manager, or a tank commander. Do you want to lead your family well? Then do what's in the best interest of your spouse. That doesn't mean they get to walk all over you and have whatever they want. Sometimes it's in their best interest for you to speak up and tell them that their actions are harming the family. But in every situation, simply use your God-given wisdom to decide what's truly in their best interest, and then do it. Do you want to be a good parent? Then give your kids whatever they need to be happy and healthy for the long term. If your child messes up, don't fret about how to respond. Just do what's in their best interest. Sometimes it's in their best interest to drop the hammer of discipline. Sometimes it's in their best interest to just pat them on the back. Simply do what's best for them and don't worry about what everyone else thinks. Maybe you're a leader at work. If so, simply do what's best for your people. And doing what's best for your people may involve firing someone. Firing someone may be the loving thing to do. If they are hurting the team, then they are hurting themselves too in the long term. And in the long run, parting ways may be best for both parties. So don't agonize over it. If it's truly what's in their best interest, then get your ducks in a row and just do it. Loving people is simple, but it may not be easy. Sometimes it's unpleasant, and sometimes it takes a little bit of work to figure out what's truly in the best interest in the long run. But it doesn't require you to twist yourself in knots trying to justify yourself. And of course, nowhere is this more important than in church leadership. One of the temptations of church leaders is to give in to the impulse to follow a policy rather than truly doing what's in the people's best interest. If following a policy and loving someone are in conflict with each other, then I recommend breaking the policy. Maybe you shouldn't even have the policy in the first place. Remember, sometimes the most loving thing to do for one person in one situation is not the most loving thing to do for another person in another situation. A policy can't possibly cover every circumstance. Policies are impractical. Policies can't love. So forget the policy and just do what's right. Timothy was to love them and lead them. He was to do what was in their best interest every time as a leader. And this simple strategy would help solve the complex problem regarding widows in the church. For the older widows, it was in their best interest for the church to support them. For the younger widows, it was in their best interest for the church not to support them so they could get married and fill their lives with meaningful work. The good feed, but the great lead. But Timothy needed to lead the men in his congregation as well. Timothy was a leader of leaders. So read 1 Timothy 5:17 through 25 this week as we learn next Sunday the importance of impartial judgment in leadership.